Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, a show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, care delivery, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Diseases at the National Institutes of Health. He's leading a large global team working to understand the outbreak of COVID-19, a new strain of coronavirus that has infected tens of thousands, killed more than 2,000, and is fast approaching pandemic status. He talks about public health interventions, precautions that should be taken, and development of a vaccine. Lori Robertson also checks in, managing editor of FactCheck.org, looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook, Twitter, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can also hear us by asking Alexa to play the program Conversations on Healthcare. Now, stay tuned for our interview with Dr. Anthony Fauci on Conversations on Healthcare.
We're speaking today with Dr. Anthony Fauci, director since 1984 of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, the NIH division leading global research on the current outbreak of COVID-19, a new strain of coronavirus. Dr. Fauci has advised six presidential administrations on a variety of global health issues and was the principal architect of the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR. He is an inaugural inductee into the Government Executive, Government Hall of Fame. Dr. Fauci, welcome back to Conversations on Healthcare.
Good to be with you.
Yeah, you know, it's been a while since you joined us in 2016 during the outbreak of Zika virus, and now you're on the front lines of a new epidemic, which you say is fast approaching pandemic status, COVID-19, a new strain of coronavirus, first identified in Wuhan, China in December, and it has spread to some 30 countries. And I think past the spread of 30 countries, we had a professor from School of Medicine at UPenn here yesterday, and she was noting that she has two young children, a six-year-old and a four-year-old, and came home and her six-year-old gave her a whole lecture on coronavirus. So we know it's spread past countries. It's really animated so much of the conversations around kitchen tables. And yet the scientific community has learned much about this new pathogens in a really very short period of time. I'm wondering if you can bring our listeners up to speed. How does COVID-19 compare to other infectious diseases you've studied? And what has you most concerned about this pathogen?
Well, what concerns me the most is what you mentioned just a moment ago. It really does have the potential to become a global pandemic. It transmits extremely efficiently among humans. Remember with SARS back in 2002, there were a total of about 8,000 cases over about a year and a couple of months. Right now, we're only literally less than 2 months into this outbreak, and we have about 10 times as many transmissions as we had in a year and a couple of months with SARS. So it has the makings of the ability to be able to really spread globally in a pandemic way. The mortality is about 2%, 2.5%, calculated on the basis of the number of cases that get to the attention of the healthcare system. But I think, and most of my colleagues believe, that the denominator of that is much, much larger. Namely, there are probably many-fold more individuals who are either without symptoms or are minimally symptomatic and are not getting counted. The bad news about that is that there are likely many, many more infections than we realize.
Right.
The somewhat good news about it is that that makes the denominator much larger, which means that the death rate is very likely not 2%, but more towards 1 or less than 1%. Remember, SARS was 9 to 10%, and MERS was 36%.
Wow.
So we're dealing with a highly transmissible brand new virus that started off in China, and 99% of what's going on is taking place in China. Mm-hmm. But we have a number, as you mentioned correctly, of travel-related cases to more than 27 countries. And in some of those countries, we're starting to see person-to-person transmissibility. Mm-hmm. So this whole thing is going to turn around on the ability of those other countries to be able to contain the travel-related cases in their own country. And countries with good healthcare systems are clearly going to be able to do it better than countries that don't have those facilities.
Well, Dr. Fauci, there is so much in what you just said, which is on the minds of people. And I think often the comparison is made to influenza or flu when we're talking about these epidemics that occur and that people are somewhat familiar with. But I think the point here that everyone is hearing is that COVID-19 is more infectious and deadlier than the flu. And we worry plenty about the deadliness of flu every year on an annual basis during the flu season. We know COVID-19 can be spread while people are still without symptoms, which is a huge concern, I think. And we've certainly seen that in the densely populated city of Wuhan and on those cruise ships, which are a living example of densely populated. And it spread rapidly there. So share with us again, what exactly do we know about the transmission of COVID-19? And what do we still need to learn? What answers are you seeking, or what questions are you seeking to answer about how the disease spreads so that we can better protect populations across the globe?
Right. Yeah, they're obviously a key question. So we know for sure that people have asymptomatic infection. We also know from anecdotal reports that are solid, they're not just, you know, off the cuff, they're solid, that there have been well-documented instances of people transmitting the infection when they are asymptomatic. Now, what we don't know is the full extent of what the asymptomatic transmission is to the kinetics of the outbreak. We know that it does occur, but is it a major driver of the outbreak, or is still symptomatic people the major drivers? When you look at influenza, clearly the major driver of influenza are people who have overt, clearly recognizable symptoms. Right now, the big unknown is that the phenomenon of asymptomatic transmission we know exists, but to what extent does it exist? Because that's going to totally impact how you screen people.
Right.
It's going to totally impact the scope of the outbreak, so that there'll be people out there who have no idea that they're infected that might be infecting other people. So we need to learn that really quickly.
And Dr. Fauci, other things that we'll learn is sort of how a country reacts. Certainly, China's reaction has been quite dramatic, and they've issued the strict quarantine for all of Wuhan and much of Hubei province. And according to some estimates, maybe 700 million Chinese citizens are under some kind of quarantine or travel restrictions. And you say this is unprecedented response, and maybe help our listeners understand why these mass quarantine approaches may do more harm, and why you suggest that the classic, well-tried public health response of identification, isolation, and contact tracking might be more beneficial.
Well, first of all, the latter, which you said, are beneficial and more beneficial than anything else. Identification, isolation, contact tracing. But an interesting thing has happened with this outbreak that is, I would say, humbled me in the following way. And I'll explain what I mean. Because for years before this outbreak, I had been saying travel restrictions really don't help when you're in a pandemic. And they may make matters worse by creating fear, by creating anxiety, by blocking off the ability to have access to resources. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that's still true. But what we've seen here, that since this outbreak was concentrated so intensely in a single country, the idea about temporarily giving travel restrictions, not permanently,
sure,
not thinking that you're going to stop the outbreak, but if it could buy you time, interestingly, despite all the caveats that I and my colleagues have been saying about travel restrictions, it seems to have worked because we have 15 people in the country or infected, 13 were direct travelers from Wuhan, and 2 were the spouses of those travelers. Now, prior to the travel restriction, something that I totally didn't realize, and it kind of shook me because of the numbers, is that every day, 22,000 people would come from China to the United States.
Wow. Yeah.
And if you have a hotspot like Wuhan, could you imagine how many people who were infected would have come to the United States if we didn't have the travel restriction? So even though it isn't a permanent solution, because once you get a pandemic that's diffuse throughout the world, you got to throw travel restrictions out the window, because you can't restrict travel from every place in the world.
Sure.
That's inappropriate and non-tenable. But the temporary restriction on a particular country or region that is the sole source of the outbreak, interestingly, did work this time.
That's great.
Well, Dr. Fauci, I really admire and respect that you're willing to say, yeah, might have been wrong, those preconceptions. And that is so important that we continue to try and learn with every one of these, unfortunately, recurring epidemics. But I want to get to the question maybe on the minds of people here at home. You've said that the risk of infection from COVID-19 is currently very low in the U.S., but it could change. So CDC is conducting tests in 5 major cities, randomly testing people for both flu as well as COVID-19, with this goal of allowing epidemiologists to get a better handle on cases that might be missed or overlooked. Tell us more about this approach. I imagine it's been done before, but I'm not aware of it. And beyond that, how should public health departments here in the U.S., which we have everywhere in the U.S., be anticipating and preparing for a buildup of their capacity to manage a response to an outbreak here, should one occur?
Okay, so that's a great question. What the CDC is doing is what's called surveillance for undetected under the radar screen. So we now, as I mentioned, have 15 individuals. Actually, there's an additional 14 because we brought the people over from the Diamond Princess ship and brought them here. They're in the University of Nebraska now, being taken care of under containment. But if you look at it right now, we're not seeing any recognizable unexplained coronavirus infection. But the question is maybe because we're not looking for it properly. Yeah. So what the CDC has done, they've taken 5 cities, New York, LA, San Francisco, Chicago, and Seattle. Mm-hmm. And what they're doing is that in a surveillance way, when people come into their surveillance clinic with flu-like symptoms, if they're negative for the flu, they'll get tested for coronavirus. Uh-huh. And if you do that, you'll pick up these undetected flu-like illnesses that might be coronaviruses. We're going to quickly expand that to many more cities.
Uh-huh.
So if you do that, I think we'll get a good handle on whether or not we're missing these undetected coronavirus infections. It'd be really very important, because what you don't want is to have this under the radar screen and then all of a sudden you wind up with sustained transmission in your country and you didn't realize it until it was too late, which was exactly what happened in China. Mm-hmm. Because in the early weeks of the outbreak, the Chinese were insisting that it's only animal to human. In the meanwhile, for previous 3 weeks, there was transmission from human to human.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't recognize it. And instead of doing the social distancing and things that you would do if you were having an outbreak, they were sort of acting like there was no human to human transmission. And there really was. We want to make sure that that doesn't happen in the United States.
Mm, that's a great strategy. Canary in the coal mine, just making sure. We're speaking today with Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, the division at NIH, which is leading global research on the current outbreak of COVID-19. Dr. Fauci, your division is now overseeing thousands of scientists around the globe, or collegially working with them, who are researching various aspects of this emerging pathogen. And there's a high level of scientific interplay going on here. And I'm wondering if you could talk about that vast network. Margaret mentioned earlier that we had these, or you did, the mathematical epidemiologists who are trying to frame up, you know, the numerator and the denominator. Right. We've seen a number of those models. You talked a little bit about the denominator. One always wonders if the numerator is right, if the denominator is wrong. But talk about those folks, the genomics, the folks who are doing CRISPRs and the like, and how that's changing how large-scale research gets done on an event like this.
Well, that's a great question, and it really is truly teamwork. The idea of an individual person, no matter how bright they might be, being the one that's going to solve all of this is just not the way things work. We have been studying coronaviruses for some time because, you know, prior to these outbreaks, coronaviruses was accountable about 10 to 30% of all of the common colds that we get each year.
Right.
So we know a lot about coronaviruses. Only in 2002, when we had SARS, did we realize that it could be a deadly virus, not just a trivial common cold. But what we're seeing now, as you mentioned quite correctly, that we have a multidisciplinary approach. We have the evolutionary biologists. We got vaccinologists because we're going to develop a vaccine. Right. We have clinicians, we have clinical trialists, we have virologists, we have immunologists, we have a whole group of people now coming together, working together to try and solve this, not only at the national level, but at an international level. Because many of our colleagues who study these respiratory illnesses are in China. I mean, many of the Chinese scientists and physicians who are addressing this now in China, many of them trained right here in the United States. So we've developed a collegial relationship with them over the years. So it's a team effort and it's multidisciplinary.
You know, Dr. Fauci, we go back a long time in terms of following your work, certainly during the early days of the AIDS epidemic and onward over the last couple of decades. The Ebola epidemic, when that happened, we watched, and in that one, we watched really with such heartbreak as people succumbed to the illness, and we were particularly struck by how devastating it was to the healthcare workforce in those countries that were deeply affected. And we're seeing some of that here with this epidemic. We certainly have seen just tragic stories out of China about healthcare workers doing a magnificent job on the front lines, doing the very best they can, but we have seen people succumb to the virus. Maybe talk with us a little bit, again, with your great perspective over these decades about healthcare workforce preparedness to respond and to respond with as much safety for the healthcare workforce as we possibly can to protect them and to make sure that they're there to take care of patients. Do you think we've made the progress with our training protocols and our drills and our preparedness to be able to really mount the appropriate response relative to our healthcare workforce if we were to have an epidemic like this here in the United States?
Well, the answer is yes, we have. The tragic situation in China, they felt that the number is that at least 1,700 healthcare workers have gotten infected in China. And it isn't because they're careless, they're running out of personal protective equipment. And they are bravely taking care of people even without the most basic of the personal protective equipment. So that's one of the problems. They almost have to reuse them when they shouldn't be reusing them. In the United States, there are certain medical centers, my own here at NIH included, in which we train and retrain ourselves periodically through the year about how to properly don and doff in personal protective equipment. We did that when I took care of a couple of Ebola patients in my hospital here at NIH. And as soon as we found out about this COVID-19, we, and I myself personally, went back and retrained about how to get in and out of the most recent iterations of the personal protective equipment. So we do have good training for that. Unfortunately, in some of the countries in the developing world, they don't have those kind of resources, and they are probably going to be more vulnerable to being infected as a healthcare worker than those of us who are in Washington or New York or San Francisco.
Dr. Fauci, you painted that picture of a collegial international group working on understanding and hopefully trying to develop potential vaccines for COVID-19. And I understand there are a couple of dozen of entities, startups, pharmaceutical companies and academic institutions who already have some vaccine candidates in the research pipeline. Can you maybe shed some more light on the timeline for a vaccine? I think the public would be very interested in that.
Okay, very good. Well, there are, I would say, you know, just almost a dozen, about 10 or so candidates that are at various stages of preclinical development. The stepwise fashion of developing a vaccine, I think I could describe by a prototype that we are working on here at the NIH. It's a mRNA platform. We're doing it in collaboration with a company called Moderna, but we're not the only ones by any means that are doing this. But let me show you what the timetable is. We're projecting to go into phase one study in about 2 months. So if you think about that, from the time that we got the sequence of the virus to the time you go into phase one, this would be the world's indoor record, absolutely sure. No doubt, because years ago it would have taken well over a year and a half to do. So we'll be in a phase one trial in about 2 months, which means 3 months from the beginning of the outbreak. It'll take about another 3 months to show safety and whether or not it's immunogenic. Then we'll go to a phase two trial. That'll take another 6 to 8 months to show that it works. So even though this is the fastest we've gone from sequence to phase one trial, it's still, even though we're going at rocket speed, it will not be for at least a year to a year and a half at the earliest that we would have a vaccine that would be deployable. So what that tells us, A, we're moving really fast, but B, the answer to the present danger is not a vaccine. It's pure public health measures. Identification, isolation, contact tracing, quarantine where appropriate.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Anthony Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases at the National Institutes of Health. Learn more about his very important work by going to NIAIDNIH.gov or follow their work on Twitter at NIAID News. Dr. Fauci, we want to thank you for the enormous contributions that you have made, that you are making to understanding some of the world's biggest health challenges, for your dedication to research and to improving public health, and for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
It's good to be with you. It was a great pleasure. Thank you.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Democrats and Republicans are waging a war of words over the president's proposed budget and how it would affect programs for seniors. President Donald Trump tweeted that he, quote, will not be touching your Social Security or Medicare, end quote, in the budget, while Democrats have charged it does exactly that. The budget does propose reductions in future projected Medicare spending, but experts say they are similar to last year's budget proposal, which included bipartisan ideas also supported by former President Barack Obama. On Social Security, the budget calls for changes to disability benefits. On Medicaid, there are more significant but not well-defined cuts. Before we look more closely at the numbers, it's important to note that we're talking about a budget that won't actually be enacted. Any president's budget is largely a symbolic statement of priorities, not a piece of legislation on which Congress would vote. In fact, the Republican Senate Budget Committee chairman has said he won't hold a hearing on Trump's budget, just as he didn't hold one on Obama's final budget. Senator Mike Enzi said, quote, Congress doesn't pay any attention to the president's budget exercise. Back to Medicare. Trump goes too far in claiming that he's not touching Medicare in the 2021 budget. There are several proposals to reduce the growth in spending over the next 10 years by about $600 billion. But Democrats, as they did last year, have spun those proposals as a slashing. Former Vice President Joe Biden said the budget, quote, eviscerates Medicare. $600 billion over 10 years would be a 6% decrease from projected spending, according to the watchdog group Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. Three of Trump's proposals, making one payment to post-acute care providers instead of different payments based on site of care, reducing bad debts, and equalizing site of service payments, meaning paying the same amount, whether services are performed at hospital facilities or doctor's offices, are similar to Obama administration proposals. On Social Security, Trump's budget proposes reductions to the disability programs, but not the retirement portion, totaling about $80 billion over 10 years. The savings would come from reducing retroactive benefits and benefits if more than one family member gets supplemental security income, and testing methods to increase work participation. One expert told us a proposal to restrict eligibility for disability benefits would affect Medicare as well, because qualifying for the Social Security Disability Insurance Program is a pathway to qualifying for Medicare for those with disabilities. On Medicaid, the budget is less specific on the details, but the left-leaning Center on Budget and Policy Priorities estimated the reduction to Medicaid and Affordable Care Act spending over a decade at $1 trillion. Part of that would come from ending the enhanced federal funding to states for the ACA's Medicaid expansion. Medicaid covers long-term care for seniors with low incomes and assets. One provision in the budget would change the asset test, a move that likely would cause seniors in states with high home values to either not qualify or have to sell their homes. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Tens of millions of people around the world have conditions that make it impossible for them to speak on their own, requiring them to adopt a computerized voice box for communicating. Perhaps the most well-known of these folks is the physicist Stephen Hawking.
I would have thought it was fairly obvious what I meant.
The problem is, that sound of Hawking speaking through his voice box is the same voice sound, say, that a 10-year-old girl with a neurologic disorder might be forced to use as well, because there just haven't been many voice options on the market.
In the U.S. alone, there are 2.5 million Americans who are unable to speak, and many of whom use computerized devices to communicate.
At a recent TED Talk, speech researcher and innovator Dr. Rupal Patel shared a program she has launched that can change that reality, Vocal ID.
I thought there had to be a way to reverse engineer a voice from whatever little was left over. So we decided to do exactly that. We set out to create custom-crafted voices that captured their unique vocal identities.
Creating a voice bank of donor voices that will allow voices to be individualized for each unique patient seeking to communicate through an electronic voice box.
Why don't we take the source from the person we want the voice to sound like and borrow the filter from someone about the same age and size, because they can articulate speech, and then mix them. Because when we mix them, we can get a voice that's as clear as our surrogate talker and is as similar in identity to our target talker. It's that simple.
16,000 people have signed up to be voice donors at the Human Voice Bank Initiative. So volunteers, like this little girl, will read a series of simple phrases over a several-hour period.
Things happen in pairs. I love to sleep. The sky is blue without clouds.
And then those phrases are matched with the voice footprint of the patient being provided for.
This voice is only for me. I can't wait to use my new voice with my friends.
Such speech synthesis will give that person the dignity of a speaking voice that is as closely matched to their own identity as possible. Dr. Patel, who's a professor of computer engineering at Northeastern University, has launched the website vocalid.com.
I imagine a whole world of surrogate donors from all walks of life, different sizes, different ages, coming together to give people voices that are as colorful as their personalities.
And with the bank of voice donors now building around the world, Dr. Patel expects that patients with conditions ranging from muscular dystrophy to Lou Gehrig's disease or stroke will one day be given the chance to communicate in a voice made just for them. The Human Voice Bank Initiative, matching vocal donors with millions of people who seek to authentically communicate with friends and family in a voice that most closely matches what would be their own. Now that's a bright idea.
You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.